take a moment to give a little context to this episode. Jeremy and I had the pleasure of spending some time with Dr. Cindy Atman talking about centers and departments in engineering education and a little bit of a historical view and then some time about leadership. It was such a rich discussion that Jeremy and I decided to split this episode into two episodes. For this episode 7, there will be a part 1 and a part 2. We'll start with our conversation with Cindy on the history of engineering education, and then we will release a part 2 with a focus on leadership. So thank you again for tuning in.
Everyone, to this month's research brief. Today, we're going to talk to a scholar that is known for transformative change within the field of engineering education. So today, we bring to you Dr. Cynthia Atman, or currently Cindy, is a professor of human-centered design and engineering and the inaugural holder of the Mitchell T. and Lee LaBlanche Bowie Endowed Chair at the University of Washington. There's so many things we could say about her and highlights of her career, but we'll hone in on a few things before we delve into today's discussion about engineering education centers. Cindy was the first engineering education recipient of the NSF Young Investigator Award, which is the precursor to the NSF Career Award. And others may know her for being among the principal investigators that led the Engineering Education Pioneers Project, which is how I met her as a grad student. Cindy was the founding director for the Center for Engineering Learning and Teaching, or CELT, the first of its kind, and it's the focus of today's discussion. So welcome, Cindy.
Thank you, and thank you for that lovely introduction. First of all, thank you so much for this invitation. And also, I want to take a moment to thank Ruth for starting this podcast and to thank both of you for carrying it on. It takes so much work to do this kind of thing, but it's an enormous contribution to the field, getting out all these stories about the good work so that we can like build on it in so many different ways.
Can you tell us a little bit about the motivations for creating the center and its current priorities?
Sure thing. I've lovely to be invited on this podcast and really lovely to have the opportunity to reflect on the last few decades. And this one of my favorite quotes comes to mind from Kierkegaard, and he says, "We live our lives forward and we understand them backwards." And I find that's more and more true as the decades go by. And you tend to tell a really coherent story when you look at it backwards, which is way different from living it forwards. And so I'll talk a little bit about that at the end here. When I look at my notes, I have some notes here. The answer to your first question, just FYI, is a little bit long because like starting CELT, which was in 1998, the whole field of engineering education was vastly different. So I wanted to sort of sketch out the context of the field and then why the heck I was doing what I was doing. And then we'll get into CELT. And then I also had the privilege of leading two other national centers, CAEE and CPRI, co-leading that with Jennifer Turns. And I'll talk about those two because centers landscape is really quite diverse. And then none of the rest of the answers are that long because they'll be based on like this whole big context I'm giving you. And one other piece of context is I'm going to be talking about my experience in the U.S. And I really want to acknowledge for the international community that engineering education is, that there is a vibrant international from the U.S. perspective. There's a viable global engineering education community. So you know, Annette Kolmos in Denmark, Duncan Fraser and Jenny Case in South Africa a long time ago. Your most recent guest last time, Esther Matemba in what she's doing across Africa, Kyria Maud Youssef in Malaysia, you know, great stuff in Australia and Colombia. So there is like lots that I'm not talking about. And Tout was founded in 1998. And I was saying that the field was way different at that point. The first ASCE I went to was in 1992. I looked up the title of my talk was Constructivism, Appropriate for Engineering Education, Like, oh my gosh, in Toledo, Ohio. And at that time, I was like, oh, what is this engineering education? I cared a lot about teaching and a lot about the, I'll get to my personal story at that time. But painting where the field was, this was at a time when NSF was funding what we call the coalitions, which were collaborations of institutions trying to actually change engineering education without a research base, but like go in there and change it to what you think it should be. Very energetic, enthusiastic, amazing people who were starting to do scholarship in engineering education. The ABET EC 2000, so accreditation used to happen by counting beans. How many credits did you have that were design? We had to move the whole field in the year 2000 to looking at outcomes. And that was like, there were kicking and screaming going on there. So a lot of things were changing in the field. If you looked across at our neighbors in STEM, there was research going on in math and science, most in colleges of education, because math and science is taught K-12. Most of the research in math and science is done from colleges of education, with some instances happening also in the disciplinary departments of math and science. But that wasn't the case in engineering. We aren't taught K-12. So there wasn't a corpus of people already doing the work. What we had were fabulously dedicated people like Rich Felder and Rebecca Brent and Carl Smith and Barbara Olds and Ron Miller, Mary Anderson Rowland. Many of them, like in the case for Rich Felder, a chemical engineer. I think Rich is the person that you interviewed for the Pioneers Project, right, Jeremy? Yes. So you got a chance to really know Rich's story. He's internationally known, a chemical engineer who, after getting tenure and teaching and going, oh, wait a second, what does this look like, pivoted to doing his work on teaching and education. And that's what many people in the field were doing at that time, had gotten tenure with the technical expertise and then pivoted to working in education. They were lone wolves on their campuses, not having a community to talk to. So when they got to ASCE, it was like, you know, great parties, you know, mostly through ERM. Really enthusiasm, hugely supportive of new people coming in. And that was where the community I joined as in 1992. The Pioneers Project, we'll talk about that at the end, so people can see some of the stories of other pioneers and on the Pioneers website. My personal story, setting up like why in the world was I recruited to start Celt? I went to high school in the 70s. So Rachel Carson, environmental movement. I started the recycling club at my high school. And people were going, uh-oh, what's this thing about technology? What's the impact? In my family, all the kids had to be engineers. There just wasn't a choice. So we had to be engineers. We had great engineers in the family. For example, my great uncle, Uncle Edward, was part of the research team in World War II that invented the aerosol spray can. It was called the bug bomb. It was to help get rid of bugs in the Pacific arena. And we were like, wow, that, like, everybody was so proud of that story. And then the hole in the ozone, you know, then, oh my goodness, just reinforced looking at the impact that technology can have. And then as I looked around the world and just saw drastic inequities in society and distribution of resources, I knew that somehow in my life, I wanted to be working to trying to solve these problems of inequities and devastation of the environment. So that was my sort of like in my heart. Then I went and got a bachelor's in industrial engineering. Graduation day, I had done some research with a professor, and graduation day, that professor told me, you should get a PhD because we need you in academia. And I'm like, ooh. I had never thought about that as a possibility. It just like, oh my gosh. So that sunk back in the back of my head. Worked for Union Carbide for a couple of years. Went to Ohio State, where Monique is. I taught Fortran, maybe in the predecessor of your department, who knows. Got a master's degree in industrial engineering. Moved to Washington, D.C., worked for, you know, and I had told myself after working for Union Carbide that I was never going to work for another large corporation and I was going to move west. But then after I graduated, I took a job with IBM in Washington, D.C. So I violated like two of the main things I promised myself. Sort of like life lesson for me there was, you know, don't promise yourself things you can't control, you know. Anyway, that was another story of a disaster. Left there, taught office automation on the Hill, taught Al Gore how to do email. Like, he was a terrible student. I call myself the founders of the internet. It's another story I could tell. It's quite funny. But then I was like, okay, there's more to life than this. And I think Don Gokenauer's You Should Get a PhD was in the back of my head. So I wanted to teach. I wanted to teach about teach engineers to think broadly. So I went to get a PhD at Carnegie Mellon in engineering and public policy. So as engineering educators, we all know that there's not a very big step between engineers and policy. And that's what this program was looking at. Got my PhD there in 1990, did a AAAS postdoc, fabulous program, and started as a assistant professor in industrial engineering at the University of Pittsburgh in 1991. I got my PhD so I could teach, but when I got to Carnegie Mellon, I figured out that I also loved to do research. My first semester there, I took a course with Herb Simon, who was one of the founders of the field of cognitive science, and loved the methodology. My advisor was Baruch Fischoff, and his advisors were Kahneman and Tversky. So my thesis was on mental models of how to communicate technical issues of health and environmental risks to lay people, being very squarely in the behavioral decision theory perspective, pushing on or in collaboration with the decision theoretics perspective of the world. So really acknowledging descriptive models are as important as prescriptive models when you're trying to describe a system and communications. And then also Indira Nair as fabulous mentor on ethics and care. So when I took my job at the University of Pittsburgh, I decided not to wait till I got tenure on something technical before I started to do research on what I really cared about. So I decided in 1991 that I was going to do research on design processes and teaching design, which was kind of an aberration at that point. Jeremy mentioned that I got the precursor to the career award from NSF, the NSF Young Investigator Award, hugely helpful because that was very green money. And I had to not only do good research, but I had to tell people that this is like valid topic to do research on. And the credibility of NSF to get a Young Investigator Award. There was only one other in my college, and that person was a chemical engineer. So it was sort of like I was doing something that had cred. So it turns out, you know, I then got tenure in 1997. I actually never forget this. My tenure letter was dated April 1st. I'm like, are you sure this is real? So we're recording this on April 2nd. If we had recorded it yesterday, it would have been like 37 years to the date since I was given tenure doing research on engineering education, which is very funny. Okay. But anyway, apparently I'm a bit risk-seeking. If you ask my kids, I'm very risk-averse in many different ways of my life. But apparently in my career, I'm pretty risk-seeking because I've I've decided to do things that like were new and didn't have existing models. So that was a precursor of the field and me. And in 1997, Denise Denton, who was this amazing person, electrical engineer, became dean, one of the first women deans, maybe the first woman dean in a large R1, large research institution in the US, and very innovative and cared a lot about engineering. And she knew me from my research, my work in the ABET world. I had just was the first woman to co-chair the Frontiers in Education Conference. That was with Larry Schumann in 1997. And so she invited me to apply for the associate dean position. And I came out, my second kid was 2 months old. That was another story. I came out here to Seattle and interviewed. And the chair of the search committee, who was chair of technical communication, said to Denise, this person is not your associate dean. This person is the person you want to recruit to start the center of engineering education that you want to start. She's absolutely right. I would be a horrible dean or associate dean. I cannot make decisions quickly. You need to do that and not regret your decisions. And that's not me. Then they recruited me out here to start the Center for Engineering Learning and Teaching. And it's a really tough decision, like another theme of like, okay, who are you? You aren't only who your work is, you know? Like two young kids, Mike, amazing husband, was a statistics professor at Carnegie Mellon. Like, do we do this? Move across the country with these two kids into this unknown thing? And Mike, to his great credit, basically said, it's easier to live with a mistake than a regret. Really kind of powerful. Like, okay. So we took the plunge, moved across the country, and established KELT. We were the second center in a college of engineering, second center in engineering education. The first one was established in 1990 at Penn State. Tom Litzinger started the Leonard Center with $1 billion from Mr. Leonard, and it was student focused. So KELT was the first center in a college of engineering that was focused on research on engineering learning, and also the super important goal of helping our faculty teach better. And like all well-engineered systems, each one of those important nodes fed into the other. So our research fed into how to teach our faculty better, what we learned from what our faculty was struggling with fed into our research agenda. And another theme, sort of like looking across, are all the amazing people I worked with. So I'm going to mention some names occasionally across because like you're never successful on your own. Like research and teaching are team sports. And on the research side in KELT, Jennifer Turns came out as an NSF postdoc in 1998, first person that came to KELT. And she's been here ever since. Like she became faculty in HCDE before me. Robin Adams was getting her PhD in the College of Ed, working on engineering education stuff. Monica Cardella was the first grad student we had from the College of Engineering. So we had great people on the research side. And then on the faculty development side, you know, there's a whole field that does that. You know, us engineers think that we can do everything, right? No. We need to actually build on scholars in this other field of professional and faculty development. Angela Lindsay worked with us for a couple of years. And then Jim Borgford Parnell, you might recognize that name. He was here several decades, really established our work with individual faculty members. And Kenya Sahara took over the mantle from Jim. So we at the campus-based, so KELT is a campus-based center, huge success with the faculty at UW who really depend on Jim and Ken helping them to improve their teaching. Anybody can come ask any kind of question that they have, and a super robust model for faculty change. Okay, so, oh my God, she's still answering the first question. Like, that's what you're thinking inside your head. So you listeners and both of you right now, you're looking at me going, this is still question number one. This is going to be an 8-hour podcast. I promise it's going to get quicker. So we were here in Celt, 1998, when Norman Fortenberry, who was a program officer at NSF, turned a CTL, which were normally K-12 centers, carved out money to make two higher ed ones, one for science, one for engineering. And so we were here and established at Celt. The RFP was in 2002. So we were able to pull together a coalition of people to respond to the RFP, and we were awarded the NSF grant called the Center for the Advancement of Engineering Education. It was $12 million from 2003 to 2010. So I'm now moving from the campus-based Celt model to centers can also be coalitions of institutions across the country or across the region or across the globe. And with two examples, CAEE and CPRI, of national coalitions. So CAEE was, like I said, $12 million over 7 years. And the goal of CAEE was to do research in engineering education. So we were part of the, we're trying to coalesce the field. We're trying to like have it be something with heft that does serious work. Actually, I don't want to have it mean at all that people weren't doing serious work before, but to really increase the scholarship in what was happening. Over 100 people were involved in the center. The leadership, there were four main campuses. So here at UW, and Sherry Shepherd was at Stanford, Lorraine Fleming at Howard, and Ruth Streveler, of course, the person who started this podcast. You'll see her name a couple times through as one of the pioneers of the field at Colorado School of Mines. So those were the four main institutions. The three main areas, Sherry led the academic pathway study, which was a longitudinal study of the engineering student experience, the thing we're probably best known for in the center. Robin Adams ran the Institute for Scholarship in Engineering Education, really specifically growing the field of scholars. And then Jennifer Turns led the Elementum Scholarship and Teaching. And also in the leadership team, Carl Smith, he was at the Minnesota at the time, and Reed Stevens in the College of Ed here at UW. And would love to have people, I don't want to say much more about CAEE, except that it's a model of a national center. Would love for folks to check out the final report. We're very proud of it. At the end of 7 years, Sue Chemnitzer, who was our NSF program officer, said to us, you won't believe this, she said, the future funding for the field of engineering education rests on the quality of the CAEE final report. We're like, Sue, what the heck did you just say? What? So, you know, we were going to do a good final report, you know, anyway. But we really, really worked hard to make it something that the field could be proud of. And so we encourage you to look at it. You can do a search on Center for Advancement of Engineering Education. Ruth did some of her famous synthesis thinking, you know, as the basis of that report. So I remember our conference room, all these spiderweb diagrams, how do we integrate all this together? The report's published as a book called Encouraging Engineering Student Success. And I'd really invite people to also look at the appendices. We have ideas for future research from back there. Back then, it was 2010. And also what we called local inquiry questions, which were questions that anybody could ask on a campus to try to figure out what is their engineering student experience like, so that they might get clues into what they could actually improve for their engineering pathways. So that was a national center. And then, which we published the final report in 2010, and Jennifer and Jim and Ken and I were then like looking across what we wanted to do next. I happened to run into Ryan Kelsey. I was on the AAU science and STEM Education Board, and met him. He was from the Helmsley Charitable Trust, and he was funding what the AAU was doing. Another funny story of a conversation with him. And we ended up getting a $4 million grant from the Helmsley Charitable Trust to fund what we call the Consortium to Promote Reflection in Engineering Education. So consortium, another sort of C word that's like a center, with 12 institutions. And we were building on the scholarship that Jennifer had on reflection. And Jennifer, Jim, Ken, and I wanted to push ourselves to say, what's the smallest intervention possible that we could implement in an engineering classroom that could have big change? And to be honest, reflection is something you can add to anything. So you can add a reflective activity. We called them additive and multiplicative. You could add it to any topic or pedagogy that you're using, and it multiplies what a student's experience is of them learning that particular topic. So we chose to work on reflection. And we also, it was an implementation grant that was really important from Helmsley. And we wanted to really honor institution type and the fact that work of equal value is done on any kind of institution, at any kind of institution. So we had four primary teaching focused institutions, four research focused institutions, and four what were called community colleges at the time, places where students get 2-year degrees. They've mostly been renamed to colleges at this point. And all 12 institutions got equal amount of resources. There was no hierarchy. There were no hierarchical, none of the institutions were above any of the others. And we all were equal. We set up the whole management structure. It was built on transparency and mutual accountability. It was really terrific. Caitlin Malouk did a paper looking at Keene and our center and CPRI and she called them guilds. It's quite an interesting analysis. And you can see amazing work there done on the CPRI website, where you can see 120 examples of how reflection is used in engineering education that you could add to your classes tomorrow. So there you go. I'm finally at the end of question one, painting what the field was like 30 years ago, why the heck I was doing what I was doing, and then like a campus-based centers and two models of two national centers. Phew.
No, I think that was great. I think it was very comprehensive and gave us a good idea of like, it's interesting, I'll say, to hear the history, right? Right. I mean, you dropped a lot of names in there, scholars who were, you know, faculty members who mentored us and we learned from, right? And to hear sort of the origin story is amazing. Let's zoom out a little and talk about centers as a whole. Could you please paint the landscape of engineering education centers, then talk about the importance of centers in a discipline like engineering education?
Absolutely. Yeah. Centers and departments are like different beasts from each other. I mentioned CALT was the second center in the country. And the first one was in 1990. So previously, like, and I talked about coalitions that were out there. And I think of centers like in two different categories. One are campus-based centers like CALT, and the activities at a campus-based center can really vary quite widely. So we did research and supported teaching at an individual level. Faculty development. You could also centers run workshops. They do evaluation. They do help with accreditation. They help with grant writing. They help with the broader impacts part of, you know, sometimes somebody in EE or mechanical engineering goes, okay, I've got this circuits idea, but what do I do about broader impact? So you can really help bring in some of the broader ideas. It can include graduate student support, undergrad student support, and they can also be places where you link with the rest of campus. So they could be STEM education centers, not just engineering education centers. And the configuration is really based on local context. What is the demand of the local context, and what are the potential funding sources? So is this, you know, funded by the institution, or is it funded by soft money? Campus-based centers generally have the possibility for being longer term in a campus if they have committed to resources. And national, and I'm calling them national, but what I really mean is not campus-based, because they could be regional. They mostly tend to be collaborations across institutions around some common goal. So like around some common research goal, or around some common diversity or implementation goal. They're generally time bound, so they're short, you know, and they're generally tied to a funding stream. And it turns out that centers are like an important way to address specific challenges that can be contextual, like I was saying, for campus-based centers, and ways to connect with either other parts of campus, or for campus-based centers, or other institutions for national-based centers. There also were centers like CACI at the National Academy of Engineering, Center for Advancement of Scholarship in Engineering Education, that was a national resource. That wasn't a collaboration of institutions, but was something that was a national resource that everybody could draw on. And unfortunately, went away, I don't know, maybe a decade ago. And then on the practical side of things, like as our field grows, it's also places, as we get more and more departments and produce more and more PhD students, they're places where there are jobs for people who are getting PhDs who really care about changing the system, you know, and making change happen. So that's sort of like the land of what kinds of centers there are. And I'm sure other people, you know, could add lots more detail to that.
Thank you. That was wonderful. So perhaps there are places that aren't quite ready to start a department for various reasons. Can you talk a little bit about the void that centers may fill in creating a sense of community, or and can you share any insights on the value of centers as precursors to departments?
Yeah. So I think of centers alongside departments, and if I answer the question instead of like at one particular institution, a center or a department, but sort of more at the field level, centers were in the conversation and sort of like an incubator and something that helped bootstrap the start of departments. So I mentioned previously that in the late 90s, like we had nothing like math and science education as a field. We had a huge advocate at the National Science Foundation, Sue Chemnitzer. She was massively creative in finding funding for the field. Her role in helping establish engineering education in the US cannot be overstated. Whenever there is a comparative study of you know, what's happening in the US to what's happening with other countries in the globe, you know, all the observations are there's a funding source. And Sue is the person who helped pull that together. She would find, you know, collaborators across NSF, and then she would help, you know, find collaborators across the field. She got career awards. She's the one who pulled together the money for the career award for me. There was another person who was awarded one, a civil engineer at Johns Hopkins, the same time I was. And she always found magical money for career awards. So the coalition's big success in my mind was raising awareness that engineering education was a thing. You know, like it was, there were passionate advocates like Barbara Olds and Rich Felder and Carl Smith. And then the coalitions were like, whoa, Alice Agogino's coming in, and Sherry Shepherd, and people got excited about the possibility of looking at engineering education. So centers provided, along with ASCE, provided a place for people to congregate. And the field started to diversify in terms of methods and questions and collaborations. And centers was a place for those conversations to happen as incubators. I found as I was looking through notes doing this, I found that one of my goals I had written down when I started KELT was in 10 years, I wanted to have 10 other centers competing with me for grants. And we got there in 3 years. That just shows you the field was ripe to start, you know, like if it hadn't been me, it would have been someone else, right? We started a community called Engineering Education Centers so that we could talk with each other and find out what was going on. Our first conversation was at ASCE in 2001, and we had 12 schools with names you'd recognize. So Ruth at Carlisle School of Mines, Cindy Finelli at Michigan, Donna Llewellyn at Georgia Tech, Sandy Corder at Wisconsin. So there were other people who were starting centers and places that wanted to start. We had conversations at places like ASCE and NSF, and people like Hayden Griffin from Virginia Tech were joining in those conversations, and Kamyar Hagigi at Purdue. So people who were trying to figure out how to help the field coalesce. And then the first departments came around in 2004 with Purdue and Virginia Tech. And as I understand it, somebody has to correct me if I'm wrong here. Both Purdue and Virginia Tech put proposals into their Board of Regents at the same time. And Purdue's Board of Regents responded faster than Virginia Tech's did. And so Purdue is able to claim the first slot. if the Board of Regents in Virginia had been a little bit faster, it would have been reversed. So that's kind of a funny thing.
I didn't know that. That's an interesting piece of history.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody should verify it, but I'm pretty
darn sure. True. It's yeah. True. Because when I went to Virginia Tech, they just said, let me clarify. And I was like, well, my blood runs black and gold for Purdue, regardless of where I work. But thank you for the clarification. It was later that year that Virginia Tech was approved.
It was absolutely. So they tied, but the record shows something different. But the record should also show that the field was pulling together, that departments came along after, you know, Tom Litzinger in 1990, you know, and people were pulling together scholars on campuses all over the country. And so the departments were part of that conversation. And thankfully, because, you know, you need departments to have PhD programs, and centers are places where there are scholars and faculty can be, you know, can congregate. But if you don't have a PhD program, then we aren't growing the field to have new scholars. And so there are some instances, I think, where departments grew out of centers. But many of the departments were actually renamed existing departments. Like Purdue was a first year engineering department that was then renamed. So there was already a corpus of faculty there that you could build on. And so in institutional change, it's way easier to find existing faculty and change it than find additional faculty lines. Like you can see at the dean's level, no department is gonna say all forego my next faculty line so we can create this new department. So that's just political reality. And then I started to track sort of centers and departments. So one in 1990, a center, two in 1998, 12 in 2001. When the departments came around, there were probably maybe 16 centers. And then Ken Yasuhara and Adam Carberry have this fabulous resource called the Engineering Education Community Resource. And using that as a source, I had looked like about a decade after KELT started. I have some plot. You can like paint this in your head. About a decade after KELT in 2007, there were 39 centers and 5 departments. And then 10 years later in 2017, there were 74 centers and 10 departments. And then I just looked at Ken and Adam's resource, and I counted, so this is actually really hard. In total, there were 125 centers and 54 departments, but that's US and international. If you look just at US, it's 79 centers and 40 departments. But then if you do an equivalent kind of what I was trying to look at, it's more like 79 and 12 to 17 departments. So it's really hard to count because are you STEM? Are you engineering? Are you College of Education? Are you, and there's a lot of things listed there, but the whole point is there's a bajillion now. And it's fabulous because the field is growing. And having PhD programs is super important. And centers still play a role in finding places for people to collaborate across common goals and across on campuses, and great places to for PhDs to find jobs. And then I also just want to mention that, you know, this resource includes a lot of I was looking at all these international centers and departments that are just like glorious. And so I just want to mention to everybody across the globe that, you know, hooray, there's, say, you know, many, many, many things going on across the globe. So.